Hello, and welcome to Advisory Explained. I'm your host, Kwesi Kretzinger. Join me in this series, this podcast where we discuss the complex world of advisory. We dive deep into very specific topics in the world of mergers and acquisitions, due diligence, tax, fiduciary services, and so much more, where we take complex topics and we break them down into smaller, bite-sized, palatable portions for you to understand and to understand where we can assist you. Welcome back to another episode of Advisory Explained. I'm your host, Kwesi Kretzinger, and today I'm joined by one of our partners, Johan Bashford, and one of our managers, Rudolf de Jager, who both form part of the financial and tax due diligence team right here at Baker Tilly Greenwoods. Like you heard it, today we're going to discuss due diligence, what it is, why it is important, and sort of where it fits into transactions, M&A side, just pure M&A readiness. We're going to look at what is a due diligence and why it matters. We're going to look at the how and the what, and then we're also going to do a deep dive into certain red flags, triggers, and industry nuances. So let's get ready. Let's dive in. Johan, what is a due diligence? For people that they've never really experienced it, never been part of it, how would you explain a due diligence to them?
So I think lots of people would see it as the less sexy side to M&As, but it's also a very important part of M&As. So due diligence is basically looking at finances, looking at tax compliance, looking at tax opportunities. You'll also look at HR, legal compliance. And it's essentially a way of making sure that what you're buying is sound, what is being sold to you during the negotiations is actually what is there. And quite often during the performance of a due diligence, you do see some additional opportunities. You might actually see that there are certain units or cash generating units in this business that aren't performing as it should be, and maybe it's something you can get rid of, or you can potentially identify growth or synergy opportunities during this due diligence.
Absolutely, and I think it's very crucial what you just touched on. Due diligence is not necessarily just a let me see what's wrong with you. Mm. It's let's see where we can have additional synergies as well. Look at the two main points of due diligence, especially what we actually do at the firm, financial and tax, how would you describe the two differences, a financial due diligence versus a tax due diligence?
So they are separate, but they also go very well together. So financial due diligence, you would look at your basic elements of the financial statements. So you would look at balance sheet, so assets, liabilities. You'll look at your income statement, so income and expenses. Whereas with a tax due diligence, you would focus more on tax compliance, potentially looking for liabilities, but you'll also look for, I would say, tax practices that can be more efficient.
Absolutely. In terms of the due diligence process, you mentioned specific sections in, let's use the income statement for argument's sake, because obviously per transaction and per industry, we focus on different type of things. For instance, a tech company, you would look at specific areas. You'll focus on subscriptions and the revenue multiple and the applicability of certain IP, if that's the case, versus a construction company or a ready mix company or something like that, or a logistics company. That's a due diligence that we actually worked on. You'll focus more on asset based. So how do you approach a due diligence in terms of deciding or looking at what is important?
So I would say, so before you typically get to the type of industry, you'll also look at the deal structure. So you would know it makes a big difference whether you buy a company, meaning you purchase shares, versus actually buying the actual assets and liabilities of the business. So already there, you would have differences in your approach. Mm-hmm. So when you buy shares, you basically get the history of everything coming with. And then where you typically get into the different industries, that is where you start tailoring your procedures. So if you work with something like manufacturing or logistics, you'll focus your attention more on the assets. So condition of the assets, how often do they need to be replaced? Are they being maintained? Looking at all of those costs that are being incurred. So typically you want to make sure that people aren't capitalizing things to the balance sheet that they should actually be expensing. Whereas with, I would say, tech companies, you would definitely focus on IP. Is it registered in their name? You don't want to buy the company that doesn't own the IP. They only have the, only basically have the devs. Secondly, you'd look at what is their revenue model. Do they do subscriptions? Do they do like tokens? So per use type of charges. And then also, I think with tech companies, you have to focus on people. Like the human capital is also important, like it is with professional services. I wouldn't say from a client-facing point of view. So with professional services, you, of course, focus a lot on the human capital that they have and how attached the client base is to that human capital. Or to, sorry, I'm saying human capital now, but I mean actual people. So people's presence and their personality and all of that that the customers are attracted to. I know with tech companies, probably they won't be client-facing, but the knowledge that a lot of developers and software engineers have is very crucial to companies, especially where they have legacy systems. So if a software company has been in business for the last 10 to 20 years, they probably have some software engineers that have been there since day one, so they understand the ins and outs of the system. And typically what we would do with the due diligence is you would identify those people that are very important. And you would highlight that, and typically the buyer would look at ways of encouraging those people to stay long-term.
Absolutely. In your opinion, and maybe you have a story that you can possibly share, of where a due diligence actually saved a client or brought a significant opportunity?
So there are a couple of instances where you would say it saved a client. So one would be... I mean, sometimes you get dodgy people out there. So one of the instances I can remember specifically is the target prepared management accounts. It didn't quite agree to what the financial statements were in previous years. So we thought, okay, now we'll just have a closer look at entries, see what is there. And we could basically identify that they were writing journals. So instead of recognizing a liability, they would actually reduce their expenses somehow. So it just the debits and credits weren't adding up. And that was a case where we could tell the client, well, listen, yeah, this is what's happening. We don't think you want to proceed with this deal based on what the management account said. And then from a tax side, we've seen things where if you dive a bit deeper and look into historical source correspondence, you might actually find something that most people would miss, and that would be arrangements with SARS. So sometimes taxpayers, they end up in prolonged disputes with SARS, and they might come to a compromise. And that compromise typically entails something to the effect of, you have this 100% penalty on this tax liability, but we'll suspend it on the condition that you don't incur, or this behavior doesn't reoccur in the next 5 to 10 years. So typically that would be a tax example of things that people quite often miss. And I would say the most opportunities you would find with DDs is potentially structuring the transaction in a different way to actually save a bit of tax. Sometimes it works on both sides. And then I think also when you look at, so typically with a software company where they would use a subscription model, and then you would typically realize, but they don't really apply IFRS as they should. So they recognize the income all in one go when they receive the income. Then you can go to a client and tell them, listen here, the revenue isn't really recognized the way it should be. So it might affect the working capital requirements if you calculate it based on the current financials. So you actually have to make some adjustments to the financials to figure out what kind of working capital requirements you are going to need. And from that case, it might just give the buyer a better sense of how much cash flow they actually need, because they might go into a deal thinking they have sufficient cash flow to run this business for the next 3 years. And then all of a sudden they realize, oh, the working capital requirements are triple what I thought they were, that I needed. And yeah, I think from that side, it does add a lot of value to buyers.
I completely agree with you. And we're going to get to it a little bit later. But two of the big topics or words in the due diligence world is quality of earnings. And the one that I personally like is quality of cash flows. Purely, I had to explain it the other day to someone in terms of what is the quality of earnings. And it's, are you making good money or bad money? For argument's sake. And then I said, but quality of cash flows. And I'm saying, okay, once again, are you making good cash flows or bad cash flows? Mm. Because we've all seen companies with significant revenue in terms of the financial statements. Mm. But at the end of the day, it's a journal entry.
Mm.
It's not actual profit at the end of the day.
Yeah, I think we could all recall a famous one from around 2016.
Yeah, that's the one. That is, and that's the type of things you actually pick up when you start looking. And we're not going to name names or anything, but that specific transaction is, if you had to look throughout the whole group, you would pick up in a due diligence if someone were able to pull all those information together at one table. I'm quite sure you would have been able to pick up something. And that's why the analysts always said, listen, it doesn't make sense, because they did a version of a financial due diligence, but for financial model purposes, not necessarily for transaction purposes. Rudolf, over to you. So in terms of M&A readiness, so before we do a deal and then we go into a LOI period and we've got interested parties, think of it like a dating scene, we sometimes do a thing called a pre-DD, a pre-due diligence. Can you touch on what that is?
Okay, so the pre-due diligence is essentially the seller preparing himself for actually sharing or selling his share or his assets. So that is just a way for him to get ready in order for the buyer to come in and actually inspect what's going on. So this essentially helps with planning for the due diligence, and it helps with the flow of the process. And the other benefit of an actual pre-DD is it gives the seller the negotiation to indicate that, listen, this is everything that is going on, and he knows all the potential risks that is coming his way. So this just enables him to negotiate on the deal.
I think that's such a good point, because a lot of times we go into a due diligence process and you find red flags. And then the seller is like, oh, I don't know this. I've never seen this. Mm. I didn't understand this. But if you go through a quality pre-DD process, also depends on your DD team, that can pick up these things and assist you to sort of get your ducks in order before the buyers come.
Mm.
So that when they come, and they come with their sharp-edged DD team that's going to cut through absolutely anything, you are ready for it. You have the correct information. And just like you say, it's preparing to get the right information in the right format in terms of a data room.
Mm. Yes. And just to add on that, Kirsty, is the red flag you just mentioned always seems to get a negative connectivity. But essentially, through the deal, we want to end up at the end of the deal with a great relationship. And to identify the red flags early means we can negotiate on the red flags, and we can actually approach this with the buyer to sort those flags out through this process and potentially have a synergy after the transaction. So red flags is not necessarily a bad thing. It's just a thing of, let's identify where we need to work on and where we need to add in our negotiations that, listen, we know of this, and this transaction might actually help us in mitigating those going forward.
Absolutely. I know the firm we assisted, Sellside, a few years ago with quite a big transaction, and specifically like you just mentioned, but the due diligence team from the purchaser side focused on the completely different and sort of wrong thing. They wanted to argue on discount rates and free cash flow forecasts in the numbers, but they forgot to look at the business. They forgot to look at physical assets and age of assets. And when something happened afterwards, which was disclosed, but the DD team didn't understand it, everyone sat with mud on their face. So it's so crucial to understand and go through that DD process pre-hand, but also for your due diligence team to understand the operations and the business that you are looking at.
That is extremely crucial. And I think especially for people thinking now about selling their businesses in future or in near future, it is often advisable to do this pre-DD before you start marketing your business. It just prepares you to, or it puts you in the, I would say, the driving seat, because now you're aware of these risks, you're aware of issues that people might find, and you would probably be able to fix it within the next 12 months before you actually find a buyer.
Absolutely. We're busy with a transaction at the moment, and if the client were, we mentioned to him, listen, let's do a pre-D about a year ago, and he wasn't really keen on it. He said, no, let's wait until a buyer comes. Now a buyer came and someone is interested, and we had to settle for almost 60% less in value purely because we did not have time to sort out certain things, and that lost value for the client at the end of the day, which is uncomfortable conversation to have.
Oh, definitely.
I know, of course, with any professional service, it's something that costs you money, but I think long-term, a due diligence, the cost of a due diligence is insignificant to what value it could potentially add.
Absolutely. When do we do a due diligence? So when's the optimal time to start?
So due diligence usually, so if we decided, okay, listen, we're going to do a sell or there's going to be a transaction, then there would be some confidentiality agreement and there would be a letter of intent, like you mentioned earlier, or an LOI. So after the LOI has been signed and what we call a data room is established, so that's where all the documentation are provided, then the due diligence will actually start taking place, because then the team can actually go into the detail, go into what is actually happening, and then start, the letter of intent is there and everything's good to go. And then we'll actually physically start with the due diligence process.
What happens if we start too late? If we leave a DD almost to the end, when just before contracts get signed?
So I think that's where Johan also mentioned the value in due diligence lies, because we're going to incur some cost actually doing the due diligence. But if we do it too late, then we're losing out on potential value that we have. So if we do it too late, then there might not be sufficient time to actually do a thorough investigation and into the detail and actually consider the potential benefits of structuring the deal in another way. If the buyer, for instance, already signed the agreements and now only we get errors or get red flags, then it's difficult to negotiate on price as well, because now all of a sudden you are essentially taking on something that you didn't know of. And by already signing the agreements, now we have to go into disputes after the fact. And I think that essentially decreases the value of actually the due diligence, where if we had done due diligence earlier, we could have actually saved by doing the providing ourselves with enough time to do it.
Absolutely. And one of the it's quite a famous comment in the M&A world is, most M&As fail because people overestimate synergies. And I think that's so crucial, because that is something that directly comes from a due diligence, both buy side and sell side, because obviously buyers want to buy something because they see value. So they're sort of in an uncomfortable position because they want to press down on price, but they also want to get the upside of the synergies. And sellers just obviously pushing for higher multiples, higher or better discount rates, etc. And that's why it's so important, once again, not just to do a DD, obviously please do one when you can, but also to have the right team at the end of the day, the right people around the table. Rudolf, we spoke about a due diligence and doing the work and all of that, but at the end of the day, there's a deliverable. So from a due diligence team, you give your pack over a deliverable to the client. So what is in a due diligence report?
So the due diligence report, like you said, is essentially your final product. Okay, so this is a This is the one thing that the decision makers have to essentially evaluate what's going on. So it's basically broken up into three sections. So there's usually what's called an executive summary. There's the scope and the procedures that were performed. And then there's the detailed procedures or the detailed findings per area. So the executive summary is usually what we start with, and that just provides the decision maker with the overall findings and the overall picture. So when he goes into the detail later in the report, he knows where to focus his areas. Then the scope and the procedures and the detailed findings could be combined into one, but essentially you'll outline what procedures you did, the good, and what findings you had, which could be the red flags that you spoke about earlier. And this is just where we document all the procedures that we did to give the decision maker confidence in what was actually performed as well. And so if he has any concerns, he could raise them if it was not detailed in the report. But we want to specifically give the good and the bad, the procedures that we did and what findings we had, so that the decision maker at the end of the day could look at this report and then make his decision or make an informed decision.
Absolutely. Johan, you've done a lot of due diligence, both tax and financial. What are common pitfalls and mistakes or red flags that you've seen countless of times? So it's things that you almost, you immediately go look for it because it's low-hanging fruit, it's easy to find, it's easy to see, and then we can start delving into other areas.
Yeah. So I think just on the pitfalls, because that triggered something else for me now. So normally pitfalls when people try to do a due diligence, so the common things would be the target isn't ready with their data room. So typically not all the information that you need is available, and then the team starts working and then it becomes a back and forth requesting additional information. So it just drags everything out. And in the end, it affects the quality of your due diligence, because the team doesn't really have this ability to look at everything at once, because you try and do two parts as the information comes in just to try and meet your deadlines. So that I would say would be a common pitfall. So starting too late or not having the information ready. When it comes to things that we frequently pick up in due diligence engagements, so tax side, I'd say it's fairly easy. People make late payments, they incur some underestimation penalties. So those are the really not major things that you can expect to see in most cases. The bigger things is where, specifically when it comes to income tax. So you'll review tax calculations and you'll see things haven't been treated correctly for the last, probably 5-6 years, where items were deducted where they shouldn't have been deducted, or they were, not added back on the income tax calc. So typically something would be, you identify that there are debtors that have negative balances. And when you start asking, you realize, oh, it's people making prepayments. So it's income received in advance, but it's never added to income tax calcs. And that's just unwanted potential future penalties that you could incur. And that's typically something you would want to warrant against. So again, due diligence is a great opportunity. If you do pick up any things like that, you can specifically bring that into warranties, and it just makes it a lot easier should something happen after the fact and you have to go back to the seller and tell them, listen, this is what happened. You've warranted me against this. I'm now claiming damages. It just makes it a lot easier from that point of view approaching the seller, and also if you have to go to arbitration, it's I would say more of a done deal. So other common pitfalls we often see is when people do cash flow projections, they might be asset intensive and they might underestimate on maintenance or replacement costs or when certain assets need to be replaced. So I would say that would also be a common pitfall for due diligence that we would pick up.
In terms of quality of earnings and quality of cash flow, so I touched on it a little bit earlier, very high level what it is. Can you explain a little bit more in detail what's the approach and sort of what you as a buyer get out of the quality of earnings and quality of cash flows?
So quality of earnings, that would be a way to calculate what is repeatable income that you can generate or repeatable profits that you can generate. So you would typically look at basically income and projections over a certain number of years. On the income statement, you'd look at what kind of income was generated, what are the expenses, and you'd specifically try and identify, well, basically two things. So things that are non-recurring, things like insurance claims or large repairs and maintenance that had to be incurred, that might only be incurred every third or fourth year, and you try and smooth that out. And then typically you'd also look for related party transactions, so quite, or the lack thereof. So quite often you might find that what you are purchasing is part of a group. The group owns a building. This business operates out of a part of that building, and they don't pay any rent. So that would typically be something that you would identify, and you'd add that to your income and expenses to calculate what is my maintainable earnings. When it comes to the cash flow, so to me, that's also the more interesting one, because the moment your cash flows do not correlate to what earnings you're generating, you know something's wrong. So quite often it might mean that people, I think they don't mind credit risk, so they might have large amount of outstanding debtors, meaning they are making massive jumps in revenue, but they're mountains of outstanding debt that is owed to them that might have become bad. So that could be one thing with the cash flows. And then also superficial kind of earnings. So if people make fair value adjustments, or I would say things that are more accounting entries than they are actual real life transactions, you'd also pick that up in cash, because those type of transactions don't generate cash. And I think with cash flows as well, it also gives you an idea of what cash you're actually going to get out of this business, because quite often people look at income statements and they look amazing, but they don't take into account all the capital investment they're going to have to make in future. So you're going to have to spend cash to actually have to spend money to make money, and the timing of when you have to spend money is very important.
Absolutely. We were actually busy with a transaction quite recently where a client, if you actually went over to the cash flow statement and you just look at the first two sections, so basically the operations section and the working capital or the capital section, excluding the finance section, the business made, let's say, 17 million in positive cash flows, which looks fantastic. But if you looked at the finance portion at the bottom, it dropped that 17 million in a plus cash flow to a 2 million in a negative cash flow, which was horrendous. But you don't necessarily pick that up out of the income statement.
No. And typically it's also how people treat, to say, income statements. So a lot of the, not income statement, cash flows. A lot of the time people, or even accountants, differ in how they treat cash flows. So for instance, the accounting standards aren't very clear on how you should treat interest on liability. So should you include it in financing activity? Should you include it under operating activity? So just knowing those kind of nuances and understanding accounting policies to know where people include those kinds of things, it's very important. And I think in your case, what people also often do is when they have intercompany transactions or intergroup transactions, they quite often move creditors or debtors through to loan accounts. And then what happens is the accountants pick up the movements in the loan accounts and they make these adjustments between operating cash flows and cash flows from financing activities. And typically that could lead to, I want to say, not being incorrect, but it's a very different view. You actually have to know how to interpret that.
Absolutely, because you're not really comparing apples with apples.
Correct.
At the end of the day, you've got this mixed fruit juice on the one side and a random apple on the other side, because people are messing around. And that's also why it's so important. And that's one of the things we actually didn't really touch on today, but we can maybe do a separate session on that in the future. The importance of understanding financial reporting in transactions. Are the clients actually doing the correct accounting? We just picked up a transaction now where a client did a very funny journal in the business before selling it. And they actually completed a deal just before signing the contracts. And then the seller said, listen, I've got a tax risk, so I'm just going to make a small adjustment in the financial statements. And then we do the transaction a touch different. And the client came to us and said, listen, can you have a look? And we said, well, that one journal that the client, the seller posted, is incorrect in terms of a bunch of accounting statements. IFRS for SME, specifically revaluations, how you can treat this specific asset. And that opened up the client, the purchaser specifically, for a lot of risk, purely because they didn't understand the complexities of the financial reporting behind it at the end of the day.
Yeah, I think that also, Kwesi, that feeds into how important it is to actually start early and start engaging with the right professionals early on. Because if you start engaging too late, it becomes a pressure cooker and then everything is just, let's get it done. And then bad stuff happens and then you want to know your risks.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Listen, thank you so much, Johan Rudolph, for joining me today. Johan, last thing, do you have two or three small nuggets or takeaways that you would leave the viewers with in terms of due diligence in transactions, what they just need to think about in general?
So I think firstly would be, don't underestimate the importance of a due diligence and what value it can add. Secondly, I would say, always be aware that it is a crucial part of any M&A transaction and it shouldn't be, disregarded, but it shouldn't be left until the very end thinking, oh, this is a box I have to tick. We should do this now. Always have that as part of your M&A plan, just to make sure that you give it the proper attention that it needs.
Absolutely. I completely agree. I think from my side, it would be start as quickly as possible with the due diligence so that you can have a proper understanding, having real-time information for making decisions. We just had a session, one of our previous episodes, with Drian, one of the directors at the firm, on the importance of zero and how that actually fills in and makes the due diligence process so much easier, having quality information quickly at hand. The second thing from my side that I would touch on is focus on quality and not quantity. For instance, and especially earnings and cash flows, the quality of your earnings, the quality of your cash flows. I remember one of our ex-partners, Chris, he once showed me a stack of financial statements and he asked me, is that a real profit or is that an accounting profit? And that really opened up my eyes to understand, listen, there's a difference, but you need to be able to have a look and understand the difference. And then last thing is to tailor your approach. Not everyone is the same. Not every business is the same. Not every due diligence is the same. Tailor your approach because it needs to be specific to the client at the end of the day. And that's a wrap. Thank you very much for joining us today while we discussed due diligence, financial due diligence, tax due diligence, pre-DDs, and why it is so important. I'm your host, Kwesi Kretzinger, and this is Advisory Explained.